Anatomy and Physiology, the Brain and Cranial Nerves, Part 3. If you remember, there were four major regions of the brain, and this is the last one, the cerebellum, which means little brain. Looks like a little bowl of angel hair pasta hanging off the posterior side of the brain stem and just below the cerebrum. But look at the first bullet point. It says this only makes up about 1/10 of all the mass of all the brain tissue, yet contains 1/2 of the brain neurons. So 50 billion of the 100 billion brain neurons are in that tight little package. Let's stop there for a minute. I mean, what's that telling you? Think about it. It means what? It means, well, something really important is going on there, and there must be a lot of action happening in that pretty important but small package. In this view, your book says it's shaped like a butterfly. I guess it kind of is. It's divided into two hemispheres by a constricted piece of tissue that looked like a worm to somebody, so they called it vermis, and vermis means like a worm, so I suppose that's a good name for that structure. I really love this gross anatomy picture. It's one of those things, again, I email to my friends or use as computer wallpaper. It's just so gorgeous to look at. It shows you a section through the brain stem with midbrain, pons, medulla, spinal cord, and then it shows the beautiful cerebellum backpack hanging off the back. The basic setup is we got the gray matter on the outside. Remember, that's this darker tissue. These are neuron cell bodies, and this is the bark of the cerebellum called the cerebellar cortex. The tiny little ridges that you see that I've often referred to as that angel hair pasta appearance have a real name. They're really called folia. So the ridges on the cerebellum you will call folia. The white matter is deep to the gray matter, just like in the cerebrum, shown here as this beautiful sort of tree-shaped looking structure. These are all the thousands upon thousands of axons that are going back and forth to those 50 billion neurons. Someone thought it kind of looked like a tree, and it does, so they named it Arbor Vitae. Arbor Vitae means tree of life. So if you put it all together, by the way, and you like root words, folia, or like foliage, means leaves. So the folia, the leaves, are on the tree. And that's just kind of cute, I guess. Now, the cerebellum isn't just floating behind the brainstem. It's actually attached to the brainstem through a series of structures called the superior, middle, and inferior cerebellar peduncles. The peduncles are axons that connect the cerebellum to the brainstem. And it's easy. Just draw yourself a picture. The superior cerebellar peduncles attach to the midbrain. The middle ones attach to the pons. And the inferior cerebellar peduncles attach to the medulla. So it just goes in order, just like the brainstem. Midbrain, pons, medulla, superior, middle, inferior. But now comes the Mac Daddy slide. This tells all about the amazing cerebellum. Look at the functions of this small but powerful package. What does it do? It evaluates how well movements initiated by the motor areas in the cerebrum are actually being carried out, then makes adjustments with triple stars. In English, it looks at what you want to do, like maybe catch a baseball. Then it looks at what you're actually doing, which may be missing the baseball, and then it fixes it so you can make the catch. So therefore, you should know, this is the main brain region that regulates coordination, posture, balance, and which makes possible all skilled muscular activities. I've put that direct quote on a question on the test, and students sometimes still miss it. Don't be that person. You must pick the cerebellum when you see those words. So what does this actually mean, though? Let me try to put this into perspective. When someone's going to catch a baseball, think of a pro baseball player making that miracle catch. Just envision that. In that very short period of time, he's got hundreds of muscles, you know, from his head to his toes, from his neck to his eyes to his fingers, his legs, his arms, his toes, his thighs, and so forth. Those hundreds of muscles are making hundreds of adjustments per second, probably, just to make that miracle catch in that short period of time. So just think about that. Every fraction of a second, hundreds of muscles are receiving corrective signals so that he can actually make that miracle catch. I have a visual, an animated visual, that kind of puts it all together. Puts a lot of stuff together we've done so far. Maybe this is even the hardest slide we do this entire unit. But after you work on it several times at home, you'll be able to get this, but it does require knowledge of a lot of the things we've done so far. We really want to focus, though, here on the cerebellum, because that's our topic of this unit. What we have here is a drawing. Up top, we got the cerebrum. We also have our relay station, the thalamus. Then we have the brainstem, including, of course, our nice potbelly pons. And hanging off the back, we got our cerebellum backpack. So let's do that example of that miracle catch again using this figure. It's animated full screen on the PowerPoint, so this is how you have to work it at home. So here we go. First, boom, watch the red rectangles. Motor areas of the cerebral cortex are going to send out a motor signal to your muscles to tell them what to do. What you want to do in this example is catch a ball. Those red motor signals go downwards, maybe pass through the relay station called the thalamus, and then they make their way to the pons. Remember the bridge. And the pons is going to bridge the signal in a couple different directions. Look what the pons is going to do. It's going to take a copy of that red motor signal, and it's going to deliver it to the cortex of the cerebellum. Therefore, the brain cells in the cortex of the cerebellum are going to store a copy of what you want to do, which is catch the ball. Then furthermore, the pons sends a copy of that motor signal downwards, descending where it hits the effector muscles, and the muscles make some kind of movement, some sort of attempt to catch the ball. Then remember, those muscles have a special sense, that sense called proprioception. Remember, where we can perceive the position and movement of our parts in space, even with our eyes closed, we know which way our muscle and joints are positioned and moving. So, those receptors, by the way, are called proprioceptors, and they send their blue sensory information upwards, ascending, and look where they go. Watch the PowerPoint. Boom! To the cortex of the cerebellum. Now the cerebellum has a copy of a signal of what you're actually doing, which may be just missing the ball. So here's the magic. The cerebellum has stored a copy of the motor signal of what you want to do, catch the ball. Now it has a copy of the sensory signal of what you're actually doing, which is maybe just missing the ball. Then it compares them, and it makes adjustments, and it tries to fix it. So it sends out this corrective signal in green, which heads upwards through the relay station called the thalamus, on its way to the top of your brain, to the motor areas of the cerebral cortex, and tells those brain cells, try again. You have to picture this happening every fraction of a second, going to multiple muscles all at the same time to make that miracle catch. And then I think once you digest all this, you'll truly believe and agree with me that the cerebellum really is an amazing part of the human body. let's switch gears and talk about brain waves. I'm going to keep this short and sweet and simple. The electroencephalogram, also called an EEG, is an instrument we use to measure brain waves. The name tells you what it does. Electroencephalogram means a graph of the brain's electricity. It is a recording of the brain's electrical activity, mostly a measure of action potentials. Remember, we got 100 billion neurons in our cerebral cortex, and they're firing off those lightning bolts. And if you put electrodes on someone's head, you can actually measure that. Now, why would you want to do that? I want you to know, so off to the side, please write down that there are some reasons to do an EEG. On the TV shows, you know, sometimes they hook the patient up to see if there's any brain activity, to see if they're brain dead. You could also look for brain disorders. Seizures is one in particular where they'll do an EEG. Little kiddies sometimes have infantile seizures, so you may see a little baby even hooked up to an EEG, for example. So let's look at the four basic brain waves in order, one at a time, starting with the alpha wave. Here it is shown as a medium speed red wave on the top of the graph. Don't worry about that graph or the speed of the wave. What I want you to know is the alpha wave is seen in an adult who is resting but awake with their eyes closed. So I just remember easy. A for alpha, A for awake adult resting with eyes closed. Then comes the beta wave. The beta wave is this little bit faster speed blue wave. It is seen with mental activity and sensory input. Say you're studying anatomy or working a math problem. That's brain activity. That, of course, is our favorite brain wave to see in the classroom, the beta wave. And it's easy to remember on the test. Beta wave, brain activity. Then comes the theta wave, shown here as a slower sort of a wave in black. While it may be normal in children, it's not normal in adults. It's seen in many brain disorders, and the example I like to use is it is seen in adults under stress. So it's easy to remember because I remember T for theta wave and T for test stress, which may be an example I give you on the test. Then comes the delta wave. Here it is on the bottom, a slow speed green wave. It's normal in infants. Also see it in adults who are in deep sleep, but otherwise it indicates damage in an adult who's awake. So how do I remember this one? Again, it's easy. D for delta wave, D for deep sleep, and D for damage, as in brain damage. This, of course, is our least favorite wave to see in the lecture class. Now we get on to something of critical importance. We've got to study the cranial nerves. You need to know these forwards and backwards, inside and out. You can tell so much about a patient's brain and brainstem just by knowing the cranial nerves. Many of you who go into healthcare, you'll be asked to do what are called neuro checks. And what you're doing on those patients, you're essentially checking brainstem function, which obviously is critical. And you'll learn very quickly how to do that. Many of you may have been to the doctor and they ask you to do all these things like move your eyes and stick out your tongue and smile and you know, say, ah. That's just not, you know, done because they're adding 50 more bucks to the consult every time you do something like that. They're doing that because they're checking your cranial nerves and they're checking brain and brainstem function very quickly and very easily, by the way. So let's get into it. In the upper left, nice bottom view of a human brain. Looks kind of like the sheep brain if you saw that in lab, by the way. If you don't like the gross anatomy brain, you could look over to the right and see a drawing of the same thing. There are 12 pairs of cranial nerves. They are named and numbered from anterior to posterior. And yes, you have to know both the names and the numbers in order. I have cranial nerves bolded on purpose because why are they called cranial nerves? Are they called cranial nerves because they all originate in the brain? And the answer is no, because if you looked ahead, you know there's one cranial nerve that actually comes out of the spinal cord. But they're called cranial nerves because all of the cranial nerves get out of bony holes of your cranium called foramina. So they're called cranial nerves because they get out the holes in your bony cranium called foramina. Why are they called nerves? What's a nerve? Does a nerve equal a nerve cell? Answer, no. A nerve cell is a cell with a cell body, with dendrites, with axons, etc. A nerve is a group of hundreds or thousands of axons. Yes, they're connected to a cell body, of course, but nerves just refer to groups of hundreds or thousands of axons that are grouped together. This is a beautiful dissection. It's just amazing to look at. After you study all the cranial nerves in detail, come back and look at this picture, and truly I think you'll look at it with some sense of amazement. It's a brilliant dissection, by the way, to look at. This is just the overview slide of the cranial nerves. It has all 12 of them in order, has their names and has their numbers. The beauty of a name in anatomy, like these names right here, these names tell you something about either location and or function. As far as numbers, I know these are Roman numerals. One year I gave a test, long time ago, and I used the Roman numerals, and students came up to me during the test, multiple students, and said, I don't know what these are. And I said, what are they? They're just the Roman numerals. And they said, well, we never learned those. So apparently they're not teaching Roman numerals anymore in high school. But now you do have to learn the first 12 Roman numerals because that's the way they still do it in the real world. And I still can do it either way, of course, on the test. Everyone I have ever known has memorized the cranial nerves in order using a mnemonic. I copied and pasted a mnemonic on the bottom of the slide to help you do just that. I learned a different one in med school, but I can't tell you what that was. Notice when we're studying these slides, on purpose, I set them all up the same way to help keep both you and I organized. At the top of the slide, we have the name of the nerve. Next, we have the number of the nerve, followed by location of the nerve. These are nerves. Again, these are wires going from point A to point B. So you have to know point A to point B, so to speak. One way to think about this is you got maybe a wire coming from a lamp, and then you plug that into the wall socket. You could think of, you know, plugging the wires into the wall socket as plugging the axons into maybe their cell bodies. And then, of course, the wires, those are the nerves, those are the axons, and they're going someplace where you're getting some effect, maybe going to a lamp to turn on a light bulb. So each slide has location. They go from point A to point B. And then at the bottom of every slide, of course, I have the function. So let's roll through it. On the top, olfactory nerve. The name gives the function away right off the top. The olfactory nerve is for the sense of smell. It is cranial nerve number one. What's point A? What's point B? Where do these fibers start and where do they stop? Let's take a look at the pictures from your text. Here is a cross section through the head. And what you're seeing is the nasal cavity and the brain above it. Here is, in purple, a little patch of nasal mucosa. It's only about 1 inch in size. And this is the only part of the nose that actually has smell receptors in it that we'll study later. And I don't know about you, but before I took this course, I thought when I sniffed into my big old nasal cavity, I thought, you know, the smell cells were all inside there. everywhere, but they're not. They're just at this one-inch patch of purple mucosa at the top of the nose. So what your book, excuse me, what your book did then was they took that mucosa and they took the bony cribriform plate and a little piece of tissue underneath the brain, and they blew that rectangle up really big and put the drawing on the bottom of your slide. Now we can see the location of these wires we call the olfactory nerve. The sensory neuron cell bodies, point A, are located in the superior nasal mucosal epithelium. Here are those neuron cell bodies. Here are the wires. Here are the axons. In other words, those are the nerves. That's the cranial nerve. Those axons carry their impulses from the nasal mucosa to this bulbous-like structure that you will call the olfactory bulb. That's where these axons synapse and where they end. So point A is superior nasal mucosa. Point B, olfactory bulb. That's where the wires go. Notice they must pass through the cribriform plate to get from point A to point B. That's an old friend of yours, maybe from bone anatomy. And I want to ask you a question about this piece of anatomy I hope you never forget. Let's say two people come into the emergency room. They both got hit in the face with a baseball bat or something like that. One person just has a whole bunch of blood, like blood everywhere coming out their nose. And the other person has a little bit of blood, but there's a bunch of clear fluid in it. And you're the triage nurse, and you say to the person with the clear fluid, well, you wait in the back, you just have, it looks like snot coming out your nose, and I got this other guy over here, and he's bleeding all over the place, so we're taking him first. Did you make a mistake? You sure did. Big mistake? You betcha. You made a huge mistake. Because what is the clear fluid that's probably coming out of that other guy's nose? It's probably cerebrospinal fluid, because probably that patient cracked the cribriform plate and then the brain water is leaking through the cribriform plate and out their nose. And if you make him sit in the back for 5 hours on a stretcher, he's going to get a meningitis or a brain abscess and things will go downhill from there. So how do you tell, by the way? Because you're going to have to be able to, determine the difference. There is a test. You can look this one up on the internet called the HALO test. Basically, you put the fluid out of the nose on this, looks like a piece of filter paper, like a coffee filter paper, and it spreads out in a halo pattern. And if it has that pattern, there's cerebrospinal fluid mixed in with the blood. So it's a cool test to check out. What's the function of this nerve? Well, it does a sense of smell, and it's purely a sensory nerve. That's all it does. Let me ask you a question, because I might ask it on the test. If I cut this nerve on the test, what problem will your patient have? Easy. You'll tell me they can't smell. Another question. How can you, as a healthcare provider, check the function of cranial nerve number one? What does a doctor do sometimes, especially the neurologist? What do? Go in their black bag. They pull out either a vial of coffee grounds or maybe a vial of ground up orange peels, and they ask the patient if they could smell it. Why are they doing that? Just to make an extra $20 on the consult? Maybe, I don't know. But for real, it's to check cranial nerve one function. Then comes the optic nerve, just by the name alone. Look at it, optic. Guess what it has to do with? Something about vision, you're guessing, and you're right. It is cranial nerve number two. What's point A? What's point B? The cell bodies of these sensory neurons are located in the retina. In other words, in the back of the eyeball. So these wires start in the eyeball, in the retina, and they carry their impulses from the retina to the sensory relay station to the eggs in the head that we call the thalamus. That is where these wires we call the optic nerve end. So point A, eyeball. Point B, thalamus. So it goes from the ball to the egg, so to speak. Don't say the ball to the egg. You're going to say from the retina to the thalamus. What's the function? It's purely a sensory nerve. All it does is the sense of sight. What if I clip optic nerve on the test? What problem will your patient have? You will easily pick off trouble with vision. How do you check it? How do you test it? Oh, that's a good question. Well, let's say you're working in the ER as a nurse, and someone comes in, and did you ever notice as part of the screening you're asked to do, you have them stand, you know, at the end of the hallway and read the vision chart? Why are you doing that? I mean, just because the charge nurse said every patient that comes in, go over there and have them read the vision chart. I mean, yeah, I guess that's one reason you're doing it, but you're supposed to know what you're doing and why you're doing it. Because if you do, you'll take care of your patients better, more efficiently, and more safely. What you're actually doing when you're having a patient read a vision chart is you're checking the function of cranial nerve number 2. I want to ask you a question just for fun. Does anybody know what a 6-month-old baby can see? I mean, if they could read a vision chart, what would they read? A lot of people guess, oh, they can just see movements or, you know, things like that. And the real answer is they can actually see pretty much 20/20 vision. And you might ask yourself, well, how can you determine that? I mean, you can't have a little 6-month-old baby sit there and read the vision chart. That's true, unless I guess it's Albert Einstein Jr. maybe. But there is this test I just want to mention. You don't have to know it. It's just a fascinating instrument. It's called a visual evoked response, or a VER. What they do is, using the knowledge that you already have, they take the baby, they put electrodes on the back of the baby's skull. Remember, that's the occipital lobe. That's where the brain cells are that fire off when you're seeing something. So they put the electrodes over the occipital lobe. Then they sit the baby in front of a TV screen. And on the TV screen, they flash this pattern of alternating black and white checks, like a checkerboard pattern. And if the baby sees it, well, it's going to send signals from the eye through the relay station called the thalamus and eventually relay it back to the occipital lobe, which if the baby's seen anything, it's going to fire off and make a recording on the EEG, or at least this special part of the EEG called a VER. And what they do is they keep making the check smaller and smaller and smaller until the baby can no longer see it. And they determine that because when there's no longer any electricity firing off over the occipital lobe, there won't be any signals that show up on the VER. So they look at the smallest size check that the baby saw that fired off impulses over the occipital lobe. And they compare that to the, you know, letter E's on the vision chart, and they match it up. And if it matches up with the 20/20 E, they say that the patient or that the baby has roughly 20/20 vision. Amazing. And all you needed was a little bit of knowledge of eyeball, a little bit of knowledge of cranial nerve, a little bit of knowledge of brain waves in the brain, and you could have thought of something like that. Cool stuff when you put it all together. Then comes the oculomotor nerve. Let's let the name help us right off the bat. Oculo means eye. Motor means to move. This is the big eye mover. It is cranial nerve number 3. What's point A? What's point B? Well, these wires, these axons, they start in nerve cell bodies, that is, in a nucleus located in the midbrain, and then they go where? What's point B? Uh-oh, look at point B. There's a whole mess of point Bs. It says these axons go all the way to the upper eyelid muscle, the iris sphincter muscle, and to all of the extraocular, that's the outside the eye muscles, except the superior oblique and lateral rectus muscles. So what do I say to myself to make it easy? Because that's kind of a lot of details to digest all at once. I just say to myself, it goes to all the eye muscles pretty much in and around the eye except 2. All you really have to remember is the oculomotor nerve is the main eye mover. It goes to almost all eye muscles except two. And then all you have to really remember is these two muscles separately. Because we will see later on that the superior oblique, it has its own separate cranial nerve, and the lateral rectus muscle has its own separate cranial nerve. So what's the function? Purely motor function. It moves the eye all around. It moves the upper eyelid upwards. Also, since it goes to the sphincter muscle, it constricts the pupil. Now look, is that voluntary? I mean, can you sit here and go, I'm going to squeeze down my pupil? No. So which nervous system is that under the control of? That is the autonomic nervous system. This is our first cranial nerve with autonomic nervous system function. There are four of them all together, and you're going to need to know them stone cold. So this is purely a motor nerve. Let's say on the test I cut the ocular motor nerve with a pair of scissors. What problems will your patient have? You will say troubles moving their eyes. How can you and how will you check it when you do neuro checks in the ICU? You'll take your finger or you'll take a pen light and you'll ask the patient to follow the light or follow your finger with their eyes. That's what you're doing. You're actually checking brainstem function when you're asking them to follow your finger. I want to touch on something that is really beyond the scope of this course, but you see it all the time on TV, so I want to mention it. Do you ever notice on all the medical TV shows like Grey's Anatomy or whatever the medical show of the day is, when people come in with serious injuries or on the stretcher looking half dead, they always get the pen light and always shining in the pupils real quick, right? And if the pupils are dilated, they're like, oh, bad, this is bad. You know, everyone looks real sad and upset. Why? Well, one of the reasons is this. If a pupil can't constrict to a pen light, more specifically, if the pupil is really dilated, and when you shine a light on it, it doesn't move a stitch, it doesn't move at all, that is very worrisome. There's a name for that, by the way. We call that big, dilated, unreactive pupil. We call it a blown pupil because it's just blown wide open. And usually it's three bad things caused it. Either the injury was so severe that it damaged this pathway we just talked about, so the pupil dilates, or there's a tumor pressing on the oculomotor nerve, which will potentially dilate the pupil, or the scary one, an aneurysm is pressing on the oculomotor nerve, and that will cause the pupil to dilate. Sometimes that's the first sign of an aneurysm, and if you miss that and send them home, that aneurysm is going to pop, and everyone's going to feel really bad about that. You catch that thing early, you send them to the neurosurgeon, and hopefully they can fix them. Our next cranial nerve is the trochlear nerve. Trochlea, I don't know if that name helps too much right now. It may come together when we do the senses chapter later. Trochlea, the root word, you may recall from bone anatomy, trochlea means a pulley. And I just remember here that the pulley pulls the eye, so that is one way trochlear can help you. It is cranial nerve number four. What's the location? Well, point A, the beginning of it, is a nucleus, nerve cell bodies located in the midbrain. And notice, these are the only axons of the cranial nerves, the only cranial nerve that exits from the posterior surface of the brain stem. All the rest kind of shoot out the front in matching pairs, don't they? If you did the sheep brain dissection, you know what I'm talking about. All those cranial nerves just shot right out the front of that brain stem, except one. Remember that trochlear nerve? That was hard to find. It came out a little trench, kind of tucked in between the cerebrum and the cerebellum, and that's the way I teach it in lab and ask students to remember it. I just say the trochlear's in the trench. The reason it's coming out from behind the brain through the trench is because it's the only one that exits the posterior surface of the brain stem. Very small, too. Very thin. And then those small, thin axons take a long, winding road before they eventually get to point B, which is one and only one eye muscle called the superior oblique eye muscle. This muscle is one of those strap-like red muscles on the outside of the eyeball. It is on the top of the eyeball. That's why they call it superior. And it goes diagonally across the top of the eyeball. That's why they call it oblique. And we'll mention just a little bit more about that when we do the eye chapter. What about function? Purely a motor nerve. All it does is move the eye, plain and simple. If I cut it on the test, what problem will your patient have? You just say, problems moving the eye. How do you test it? Easy. Once again, you just ask the patient to follow your finger or follow the light or whatever. Since this is the smallest cranial nerve, which sounds like a test question, by the way, and it follows this kind of a long and winding road, it is very easily injured during trauma cases, motorcycle accidents. Used to see it all the time. Patient would come in and they would be all cross-eyed because they bruised the trochlear nerve. The trigeminal nerve is our next nerve. Let's take a look at the name right off the bat. Tri means three, and this nerve does have three branches. It is the largest cranial nerve, and I think of it like a big, large tree with three big branches, and that's really one of the ways I remember a couple of the important facts regarding this nerve. It is cranial nerve number five. Was point A, was point B. It starts in nerve cell bodies, that is a nucleus located in the pons. And then from there, where do the wires, where do the axons go? What's point B? Well, there's lots of points B's here too, aren't they? The axons are distributed through three branches. That's why it's called the trigeminal nerve. It has three branches. The ophthalmic branch goes to the part of the head around the eyeball. The maxillary branch goes to the part of the head around the maxilla, just like the name tells you. And then there's one branch that goes around the part of the head that's around the mandible. And guess what some genius called that branch? The mandibular branch. So each branch tells you where it's going. Ophthalmic around the eye region, maxillary around the maxilla region, and mandibular around the mandible region. So it's easy. I picture a big tree trunk, and I grow the trunk out of the pons. So I have a tree trunk growing out of a potbelly pons. That's my visual. And then I shoot off three branches off the tree. And that's one way I remember it for the lab, too. What about functions? This is, notice, our first mixed nerve. Remember, that means it has both motor and sensory function. Let's check them out. What's the motor function? Well, it's easy. The mandibular branch moves the mandible. It ain't rocket science. So this helps us to chew. But the main function with triple stars is sensory. Look, three stars next to that. It does pain, temperature, touch from the skin, the eyes, the teeth, and the anterior two-thirds of the tongue, but not taste. What I usually do, and if I were you, I'd kind of draw a line. Basically, what this slide says is the trigeminal nerve is responsible for sensations like pain, temperature, and touch from the entire front two-thirds of your head, including the eyes and the teeth and the tongue. So draw kind of a diagonal line there, and that's the trigeminal nerve. How do I remember this? Because those of you who are studying and even looked ahead know that this is one of the two hardest cranial nerves to remember. It has a lot of different functions, a big distribution, and it's easy to mix up with another one down the road. Don't do it, though, because I'm going to give you a visual. Here's my visual where I never forget. I think of trigeminal man as pitchfork man. So I take a 3-pronged pitchfork and I poke the man around the eye, around the maxilla, and around the mandible. So a 3-pronged pitchfork right in the face. That reminds me of the distribution of the nerve. That reminds me it's mainly a sensory nerve. That reminds me of the 3 branches. Also, when you do pitchfork, man, he winces in so much pain, he bites the front of his tongue. That reminds me, by the way, that this nerve supplies sensations from the front 2/3 of the tongue. So please remember trigeminal man as pitchfork man. I know it's corny, but it works. If I cut this nerve on the test, what problems will your patient have? Well, they might be numb in the face, and they might have trouble chewing. As a doctor, how do you check it? How do they check it? You've seen this done. Well, you can just take your fingers and touch both sides of someone's face and say, "Can you feel me touch you?" And they'll say yes or no. And if they say no, they might have a problem with their brainstem or some part of the trigeminal nerve that we just studied. What about dental anesthesia? This stuff is real. When you go to see the dentist and you have a cavity, let's say, I don't know, on the right lower jaw, you got a tooth that's got a cavity and they're about to, put a filling in. What does the doctor do? The doctor takes the numbing medicine and the doctor finds where the trigeminal nerve, specifically the branch, the mandibular branch, comes out a little foramen, a little hole on the inside of the mouth. And the dentist knows, hopefully, where that hole is. So with one shot, hopefully, the doctor injects the numbing medicine and boom, what happens? That entire lower half of your jaw and teeth are numb. And did you ever notice also at the same time that your tongue feels heavy and numb too? Yeah, because it's all in the distribution of that branch of the trigeminal nerve. So again, if the doctor knows what he or she's doing, one shot gets you all numb just like that. So yes, this is real life and this is important. You'll also see this involved in a disorder called trigeminal neuralgia, which just means people sometimes get pain in the trigeminal nerve. And what doctors will do, again, knowing the anatomy and distribution of the nerve, knowing the tiny holes in the skull where the nerves come out, they can go to these pain clinics and they can get pain injections to give them some temporary relief from their condition called trigeminal neuralgia. So yes, this is real stuff. You gotta know it. Next nerve is called the abducens nerve. Let's take a look at the name. Abducens tells me, well, it's probably going to abduct something. Remember your word abduct with a B? B means to, I think of it, to blow away. So abduct means to take away from the midline or blow away from the midline. One example I hate to use, of course, is if someone's abducted, they're taken away. So abduction means to take away from the midline. This is cranial nerve number 6. What's point A? What's point B? The nerve starts in a nucleus, nerve cell bodies, that is, in the pons, and it carries its electrical signals through the wires that we call the abducens nerve to one and only one eye muscle called the lateral rectus muscle. Look at your terms. It's easy. Lateral means side. Rectus means straight. This is the muscle that runs straight along the outside of each eyeball. So what's the function? The function of the abducens nerve is purely a motor function. It moves the eyeball. But this nerve, I want you to know exactly how it moves the eyeball. And the name tells you. It moves the eye outwards. So the right abducens nerve moves the right eye out, the left abducens nerve moves the left eye out. So if I clip it, what problem specifically will your patient have? They won't be able to move that eye out to the side. How could you check it specifically? You ask them to follow your finger out to the side. And if they can't move their eye out, there may be a problem with the abducens nerve, or with the brain stem. Remember, you're checking brain stem function. That's the cool thing about this. So, let's talk about some real life examples. You may have seen a little baby with what's called lazy eye. That would be maybe a child you see where they have one eye crossed in towards the nose. Did you ever see a baby got one eye crossed in towards the nose and one eye straight? Well, what they found was, interestingly, at autopsy. Now, they don't do the autopsy for the crossed eye, obviously. When the person dies later in life, they do an autopsy. And when they sectioned through the pons, they found that the nucleus, that the nerve cell bodies for these wires were not formed properly, like they were too small or not enough of them. So one of the reasons we found for that lazy eye crossed in was that the pons just had a poorly developed nucleus for the abducens nerve. This nerve is also easily injured, similar to the trochlear nerve. Our next nerve is the facial nerve. Let the name help you. The facial nerve, I'm just taking a wild guess, is going to have something to do with the face. And yep, you'd be right. It is cranial nerve number 7. What's the location? This nerve starts in a nucleus located in the pons, and then it goes where? Look what point B is. It's basically the face. But it goes beyond the face. It extends upwards into the scalp and then downwards past the mouth into the neck. So it kind of spreads out, like spreads out all the way from the face upwards over the scalp and then downwards to the neck. Where is it mostly going there, by the way? It's going to the face, the scalp, and the neck muscles with a star, because what's one of the main functions of this nerve? It's to move the face, scalp, and neck muscles. So when people make various facial expressions like smiling or an angry face or whatever, that is from the facial nerve. When someone squeezes their eyes shut, that's from the facial nerve. Look what else it does as far as the motor function. It goes to our tear glands around the eyes and also to some of our salivary glands. Now, wait a minute. Are those under voluntary control or not? I mean, can you just sit here and say, oh, I think I'll squirt some tears out? No. So this is under the control of the autonomic nervous system. This is our second autonomic nervous system nerve. It's also our second mixed cranial nerve. In other words, it has both motor and sensory functions. What is its sensory function? This nerve, called the facial nerve, does taste from the front 2/3 of the tongue. What's one way I remember that? I remember I can't taste my face without my facial nerve. Yes, it is a mixed nerve, and it's a complicated nerve. How do I remember this? Because out of all the nerves, this is probably the hardest one to remember all the functions. And you don't want to mix it up with something else. Do not mix it up with trigeminal man. That's totally different. That was pitchfork man. The facial nerve man is going to be different. Facial nerve man is going to be Halloween man. Halloween man, I want you to picture this. Some guy on Halloween is coming at you with a big, old, ugly, distorted, and contorted face. That reminds you that the facial nerve is going to the facial muscles. Then as he's coming at you and getting closer, there's tears squirting out of his eyes. And he's salivating, foaming at the mouth. And as he's coming at you, he's licking the foam off his face with his tongue. Well, I know that's kind of a corny example, but that's the kind of thing that sticks long term. And if you remember Halloween Man, you will remember all of the things you need to know about the facial nerve. I mean, doesn't that cover it? You have that mental image I just gave you of Halloween Man, and it gets it all with one quick image. Let's say on the test, I clip this nerve. what problem will your patient have? And you'll say, problems making facial expressions. Easy. How can you test this nerve? Well, did you ever see the doctor ask the patient to smile, close their eyes, or raise their eyebrows up? Were they doing that just to make the patient make a funny face or make 50 more bucks on the consult? Probably not. They were doing that to check facial nerve and brain stem function. You will see this nerve involved in a fairly, I guess, common condition called Bell's palsy. Bell's palsy is a paralysis of the seventh nerve, of the facial nerve. Most often we think it comes from a virus. A lot of people think it's a herpes virus that does it. There's other reasons for it. Of course, you're going to get a brain scan to make sure they don't have a brain tumor as well. But when they have a Bell's palsy, their face kind of droops on one side. They lose that muscle tone. The side of their mouth, the corner of their mouth kind of droops down. They start to drool a little bit out of there. And also they have a really hard time closing their eyes. And once you make the diagnosis and rule out anything really bad, one of your big jobs is going to be to lubricate their eyes, because if you don't lubricate their eyes, if they have a facial nerve paralysis, their eye will dry out and can get a serious sight-threatening infection. So don't forget that. Next comes the vestibulocochlear nerve. That's a big name, I know. This will make more sense when we do the senses chapter, but let's break it down now. Look, this is a two-part name, a two-part nerve with two-part location and two-part function. Let's break it down. So here are the two branches. The first branch of the vestibulocochlear nerve is the vestibular branch. It is the balance branch. We'll learn later on in the course that the vestibular stuff is the balance stuff in our head. The vestibular branch, these axons, what's point A and point B? These wires, these axons, start in the inner ear and they take their impulses to a nucleus in the part of the brain stem called the pons. So I want you to remember that the balance branch mostly goes from the inner ear to the pons. How do I remember that? Well, when I think balance, I think maybe going on a roller coaster and going round and round on some loop-de-loops and corkscrews. And then I remember my big pot-belly pons goes round and round and round. So that's the way I remember the balance branch always goes to the round pons. Well, you could come up with your own way. What about the cochlear branch? The cochlear branch is the hearing branch. Those of you who've heard about cochlear implants may know that it's the hearing branch. A cochlear implant is to help somebody with a hearing problem. The hearing branch, called the cochlear branch, has a point A and a point B as well. These axons go from the hearing part of the inner ear that we'll study later on, and those wires then extend to another part of the brain stem. They mostly end in the medulla. So from the inner ear to the medulla. How do I remember that? I just remember I can't hear my favorite song, Funky Cold Medulla, without the medulla. Anyway, that works for me, but you can come up with something else that works for you. So what's this nerve do? This is purely a sensory nerve. Only does the sense of balance and hearing. So if you've been paying attention, we have three purely sensory nerves. Number one, olfactory. Number two, optic. And number eight, vestibulocochlear. We'll take a look now at the glossopharyngeal nerve. Please let the name help you. Glosso means tongue. Pharynx means throat. This is the tongue and throat nerve. It is cranial nerve number 9. The nucleus is located in the medulla, and these wires come out of the medulla, and where do they go? Well, they go to the tongue and the throat. That's why I'm glad it's called the tongue and the throat nerve, or the glossopharyngeal nerve. It tells you exactly where they go. And what do those axons do when they get there? Well, this is our third mixed nerve. It's also our third autonomic system nerve. Look what it does. Number one, motor functions. It goes to the muscles of the tongue and the throat and helps with swallowing and speech. It also goes to some of the salivary glands here by the ear. And again, those are under control of the autonomic nervous system. Sensory functions. It does all sensations, including taste, on the posterior one-third of the tongue. I just remember the name again. The name is the tongue and throat nerve. So it does the part of the tongue that's back near the throat. And that's the way I remember it does everything on the back third of the tongue. Yes, it's a mixed nerve with both motor and sensory functions. Or what would happen on the test if I clip this nerve? What problems might your patient have? Trouble with swallowing? Trouble with speech? Yeah. Maybe trouble with taste on the back part of the tongue? Well, that's a little bit hard to test. How can you test it? What does the doctor do, or what might you do when you're doing neuro checks? You can ask the patient to swallow, or did you ever see when the doctor asked the patient to open their mouth and say, ah? Notice when you say, ah, you feel those muscles towards the back of the tongue and throat kind of contract. Why is the doctor doing to the patient open to say, ah? Just, again, to make more money? No. It's to check cranial nerve 9 and brainstem function. There's a reason for it. By the way, these patients who have injuries to the glossopharyngeal nerve or tumors involving this pathway, they have a classic sort of presentation, and I actually missed it. I was kind of shown up by an ENT resident one year. We both got called to see the same patient who was in an injury, involved in an injury. I was called to examine the eye. He was called to examine something else. But we both came at the same time and did our complete physical examinations. And he said, the patient has a paralysis of their glossopharyngeal nerve. And I was like, oh, yeah, I don't know, I guess so. And the fact is, I actually missed it. I said to him, how'd you know that? He said he talked with a real hoarse voice. And the guy did. I'll never forget the guy. When I took the history and spoke with this guy, he talked like he was smoking for like 50 years. And so I just thought he was a smoker. But if I would have just asked him, he would have told me that before the injury, he talked normally, and this new hoarseness to his voice just happened immediately after the injury. People who injure this pathway or this nerve, they talk like they've been smoking forever. They talk with a real hoarse voice. So now, you'll never miss that. Our next nerve is a biggie. It's the vagus nerve. What is the root word vagus? Like vagrant mean, it means to wander. And this nerve, cranial nerve number 10, does wander all over the place. And that's how it got its name. Where's point A, point B? Well, it starts in a nucleus, nerve cell bodies located in the medulla. And from there, these thousands of wires go to point B, which is everywhere. Look where they go. All the way from the head to the neck to the thorax to the abdomen. They go pretty much everywhere. They wander all over the place. That's why it's called the vagus nerve. Mostly what I want you to know is this. This is huge. The vagus nerve carries motor impulses to and sensory impulses from most organs in the thoracic and abdominal cavities. That's huge. Huge what? It is major autonomic nervous system function. I mean, these things right are under cruise control. And it's parasympathetic function. We touched on this briefly before, on the rest and digest kind of functions of the parasympathetic division of the ANS. So your book even says that about 80% of all the parasympathetic autonomic nervous system outflow is carried through the vagus nerve. So yeah, you bet this is a huge nerve to know about. One year I was given this discussion, and one of the girls in the class says, well, I don't know that root word. I don't know what vagrant means. Never heard of that. So I can't really put this together like you just told me. But here's what I do know, she said. And I'm going to steal this from her because it works. She says, one thing I do know is I know Las Vegas. And she said, you know, whenever I'm in Las Vegas and I'm wandering around Las Vegas, I notice that there's all different kind of buildings. And if you've ever been there, you know, they have like a fake Eiffel Tower and a fake thing from Venice. And they have a fake buildings from New York. So she pictured herself wandering around Las Vegas and seeing like a building shaped like a heart and a building shaped like a liver and one building shaped like the stomach and a building shaped like the guts. And I said, I'm going to steal that. That sounds like a good way for maybe for other students to remember the distribution of this nerve. And then furthermore, we can nail down the function of the nerve by remembering Las Vegas too. Because if you've ever been to Las Vegas, you know they got those buffets, right? You pay one price and like all you can eat kind of chow down. Well, that's a lot of resting and digesting, isn't it? So it reminds me of the autonomic nervous system parasympathetic function that this nerve has as well. So I guess we could use the Las Vegas example, whatever works for you. Okay, let me ask you a question now. If I clip this nerve on the test, what problems might your patient have? Well, they might have problems resting and digesting. They might have problems digesting their food because maybe they can't move the muscles of their guts. Maybe they can't squirt out the digestive juices that they need. How can you test it? It's kind of more difficult, isn't it? How do you test the vagus nerve? I'll give you one way. The doctor takes his or her stethoscope around from their neck. Yeah, sometimes they listen to the heart, but did you ever notice they also listen to the belly? What for? Well, they listen for bowel sounds. So if they hear gurgling down there, one of the things that tells them is the vagus nerve must be probably working because it's making those muscles churn and the juices squirt. So that's one way you could kind of make an assessment of the vagus nerve. As a matter of fact, when I went to school, I don't think they do it anymore. People who had stomach ulcers and so forth, we didn't have all the fancy drugs like we have now for taking care of stomach acid problems and all that. So what we did actually in the old days is we cut the part of the vagus nerve that went to the stomach to help them with their stomach problems, and it's simply called a vagotomy. And so, yes, it is useful. It's important to know this stuff. It comes into play in real life. Our next nerve is the accessory nerve. I'm not sure how much that name helps you just yet. Accessory means to help. It is cranial nerve number 11. Where does this cranial nerve start? Because this is the odd man out. This cranial nerve is the only cranial nerve that originates from the cervical portions of the spinal cord with a star. Yeah, this is the only cranial nerve that comes out of the spinal cord. Where does it go? Point B. It goes to muscles in the neck region. It goes to your old friends, the trapezius and the sternocleidomastoid muscle. Just remember the neck muscles. What's the function? Purely motor function. It just moves the head and the shoulders. So if someone can move their head side to side and shrug their shoulders up and down, that's a good way to test the motor functions of this nerve. But some of you are thinking, now wait a minute, how do I memorize this one? I'm not really finding anything to tie this one together. So I have something for you. Whenever I think accessory, I think accessorize, right? I mean, you got to accessorize. You got to put on some bling, right? Is that what we still call it? So I'm going to put on myself or on this person, I'm going to put a necklace. So here goes a chain I'm going to put around the neck. And that reminds me that this nerve goes to the neck muscles. Then did you ever see those kind of a chains, those kind of a necklaces that have the one piece kind of dangling down? Well, I dangle that one little piece down the back of my neck. That reminds me that this is the only cranial nerve That comes from the neck portions of my spinal cord. So now I have a good visual for you for the accessory nerve. When you think accessory nerve, think accessorize. And just put on yourself a chain around your neck with another little piece of that chain dangling down the back of your spinal cord. Our final nerve is the hypoglossal nerve. Let the name help you. Glossal means tongue, and sure enough, it's going to do something to the tongue. It is cranial nerve number 12. It originates in a nucleus in the medulla, and then the axons that we call cranial nerve 12 are distributed to the tongue muscles. The name tells you where it goes. It goes to the tongue. All it has purely is motor function. It just moves the tongue. That helps us with both swallowing and speech. So, if I clip this nerve on the test, for example, what problems will your patient have? You could say problems with swallowing or speech. How can you test this nerve? Oh, that's a good one. Well, the doctor does it all the time. I bet you had it done yourself by your doctor. What does the doctor say? Open your mouth and stick out your tongue. Why? I mean, again, just to jack up the bill for the day? No. I mean, I hope not. It's to check cranial nerve 12 and therefore brainstem function. And it's kind of interesting the way that the tongue muscles work. You have a right and left cranial nerve, everything, including right and left cranial nerve number 12. And the way it works is when the cranial nerve number 12 fires off and goes to your tongue muscles, it actually pushes the tongue out of your mouth. So that what? So that let's say there's a tumor in the right medulla affecting the right hypoglossal nerve. Now you ask the patient to stick their tongue out. What happens? Well, the left side is working fine. So the left side of their tongue pushes out, but the right side really doesn't. So what happens? When they stick their tongue out, it curves to one side. As a matter of fact, in the example I gave you, it will curve to the right. And here's another little tidbit I'll give you. Easy to remember, thing they taught me in med school. The tongue will always point to the side of the lesion. So if you ask a patient to stick their tongue out, it curves to the right, there's probably a problem in the right side of the brainstem. If their tongue curves to the left, there's probably a tumor or stroke on the left side of the medulla. So that's a little tidbit you can carry with you into the future. If you looked at these next two slides, these summary slides, and I hope you all have, there's absolutely nothing new on these slides. We've covered it all in great detail because it's so important. And one day I sat down a few years ago and I said, well, what if I was a student wanting to get organized and study this stuff, or if I was a teacher thinking of how to make test questions, how can I organize all this stuff? And then I came up with these two study sheets. So I'm not going to read it to you, but look what's up here. It tells you, for example, which ones are only sensory. Number one, number two, and number eight. Which ones are purely motor? Which ones are mixed? 5, 7, 9, 10. Which ones have autonomic parasympathetic function? There are only four of them. 3, 7, 9, 10. Those should roll off the tip of your tongue when it comes for test time. On this slide, it says which ones come out of the midbrain, which ones come out of the pons, which ones comes out of the medulla. It says which one is the only one that comes out of the spinal cord. It says which ones move the eye, 3, 4, and 6. Which ones contribute to swallowing and speech, 9, 10, and 12. It says which one is the smallest and most easily injured. It says which one is the biggest. It says what does the front of the tongue, what does the back of the tongue. So what a beautiful summary, a great way to organize as a student, and really a cool way for me to ask you test questions as well. You should get to know these two slides. Study them at home on your own. They're great study sheets. Before we end this unit, though, something really cool. Notice at the bottom. Note that both nerves involved in taste, 7 and 9, also help produce saliva. You know what's interesting about that is this. Do you ever notice if you have a really dry mouth In other words, if you're not producing enough saliva, your food doesn't taste as good, does it? In other words, you can't really taste things well without the proper amount of saliva. And isn't it kind of amazing the way the design is that both nerves that do taste are also both of the nerves that do saliva? That's a cool setup.